In just a moment, we've got Robert Love paying us a visit here in the Novell Open Audio Studios. And back by popular request, we've got news from support. It's all coming at you right now on Novell Open Audio. Welcome to Novell Open Audio, the podcast that connects the Novell user community with what's going on inside and around the Novell universe. I'm your host, Ted Hager.
And I'm Aaron Quill.
And, you know, what do we got going on here, Aaron? We've got some stuff that's happened, I guess, from... we had a follow-up item from Lug Radio Live that we forgot to bring up.
We did. When we were out at Lug Radio Live, we got cornered by a listener asking if we were ever going to be regular.
Cornered nothing. We were presenting in front of the room, and he asked us this. He said, is the show... It's not. He didn't ask if we're going to be regular. Let's not leave it that way. He asked if we are going to ever have the show released on a regular schedule where people can count on it coming out on a regular schedule. What's your thought?
The answer's no. Well, no, actually, let me clarify that. First, shameless plug for one of my favorite podcasts. I think Discovery News handles it perfect. What Discovery News does, they do a very, very good science newscast, and they come out guaranteed once a week, unless something cool happens. If something cool happens, they'll drop 3, 4, 5 episodes a week. It doesn't matter.
A Mars rover happens, or there's a Cassini flyby with a satellite around Saturn or whatever, they'll throw out several different episodes to cover that topic more.
Exactly. And that's exactly what we want to do here with Novell Open Audio. What we want to do is we want to guarantee that we're going to produce an episode, let's say, at a minimum every 2 weeks. And then what we're going to do is when Ted and I run into interesting people or have an interesting topic, we want to record it and get it out there when it's still fresh.
And we've seen this happen with, like, events as well. Like BrainShare, we had a blitz of really short different interviews that we got out there for people. And then also at Linux World Expo, the Nat Friedman and the Jeremy Allison episodes that we put out, those came out successive days the evening that we did the recordings. And that was just because we had the material, we wanted to get it out there.
Yeah, and we really... a lot of this information is very timely, so we want to get it out as soon as possible so that you guys have access to the stuff that we just recorded.
But that leads us to a question. We're actually at our you may not know this, but it is pretty much our 6-month semi-anniversary. I don't know what you call it. So we've been doing Novell Open Audio now for 6 months. We started back in February. It's now August.
Wait, 6 months? Just out of curiosity, how many episodes have we produced?
I think this is our 35th episode now in 6 months.
I hope my boss is listening.
Yeah, so this brings up a good question, though, and this is why we're talking about this right now on the show before we get into the good material that we have this week. We're wondering how we're doing. We wanted to do a checkpoint. Now that we're at 6 months, we're going to put another survey online for this episode. We'll have the survey up so that you can go on and fill it out. And as always, we've got some bait for you. We've got, what do we call it? Swag.
We got some swag.
We got, actually, I've managed to score some of the Novell President's Club. This is the thing that the Novell sales guys go to each year. These green backpacks. They're very much limited edition. They're not BrainShare backpacks or anything. I've got two of them that I'm going to do random drawing for on the survey. And Aaron and I want to read through some survey results. It'll be a mini version of our last survey. It'll be 10 questions or fewer. And we're just trying to get some people's feedback on, are we putting out too many shows, too few shows, too long, too short, deep enough technical content, too light? Or anything like that. What topics do we need to cover more? So we'll have that survey online.
Yeah, please let us know what we're doing. What you need to understand is Novell Open Audio is really just a small anarchy project that Ted and Aaron have pulled together and are trying to put out there. And we just want to make sure that it really meets your needs. And it's something that's helping you guys and is beneficial.
And speaking of anarchy, it's time to get into our first segment here. Remember, hit the website. Fill out the form, maybe while you listen to this. But it's time to catch up with Dave Mayer and Randy Goddard with news from support. All right, we're recording this particular segment on the 23rd of August, and you're probably getting it about a week later. So this information is au courant as of the 23rd of August, and this segment is News from Support. And we've got back in the studio with us at long last, Dave Mayer, Randy Goddard, joining us again. Welcome back, guys.
It's so good to be here, Dad.
It's been a long time since we had you here, and we got a little story to tell you. Just, listeners haven't sent in their feedback. We've asked, hey, how are you liking the News from Support segment? We haven't heard anything back from people. And I was kind of feeling like, you know, this segment is an unloved segment. But at Linux World Expo, when we were doing the two live in front of a studio audience recordings with Nat Friedman, next day with Jeremy Allison, we had somebody come up to Mike, the audio guy here, and say to him, hey, where's News from Support, Ben? We haven't heard from that for a long time. So you guys are loved.
Or at least somebody's listening.
At least one person is listening. So, in the past, about a month since we had you guys on?
Three, 4 weeks.
Yeah, so in that past time, SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop and Server have been released and are out there, and there's already some patches coming in. Randy, you got anything you can let us know about these patches that have been coming through?
Mostly that the updates are most of the kind of underlying basic bits and pieces of the OS, nothing real big security-wise, which is a good thing.
They're like minor security things, just things that are standard in like the upstream stuff coming down, right?
Uh-huh. GPG is probably the biggest thing that I can think of that might have anything to do with security. And the rest are just kind of innocuous little pieces that are being updated.
Each one of those I've noticed, if you're subscribed to the Customer Center, suddenly a lot of people are turning on rules on their inbox to push those things into a special folder so they can check them.
But it's that round folder?
Yeah. Each one of them has information on it, what the patch is, so you can actually dig into it. So we're not going to cover all those patches right now, because I'm sure it would make a fascinating show if we were trying to do, I guess, cable TV. But we're aspiring for a different level of mediocrity here on Novell Open Audio.
And so, we'll do our best.
Let's hit Dave's TIDs. What do you have on technical information documents this time?
Just like Randy said with version 10, there's not been a lot. I only picked things from the last week because to go back 4 weeks, things would get really confusing and we'd be here all day. And in the last week, there's nothing that I would call a security issue. There's a couple of fun ones, but issues fixed with downloading and installing patches on Open Enterprise Server. There's a new patch, 1.11.47, that you should install. It's an update to RCD, and it patches the mechanism for OES Linux. And if you restart the red carpet daemon, then any patches after that will be listed and in a less verbose way. Would be the best way to put it. So it gets a little easier to maintain your
sort
service.
Of summarized lists rather than just core dump of every little detail.
And it doesn't then you no longer are required to download all patches in the channel, which are currently 1.4 gigabytes. So upgrade your modem to 56K or install patch 1.11.47. So that one is probably the closest to a security issue, because if you have to download 1.4 gigabytes in order to patch your server, then there are some people who may not be able to patch their server for that reason alone.
And we'll remind our listeners briefly that we do put online all the links to the different TIDs that Dave tells us about each time we do News from Support. So you'll be able to find it on the lists. And also, I'll make a quick mention that we apologize about the late posting of some of the TIDs last time. They did get posted, but there were a couple of people that said, where the heck are they? Which is another validator for you guys. Continue, Dave.
It's that same listener.
Yeah, exactly.
So when installing SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop 10 on a system that had Windows on it and had a pre-existing NTFS file system, the customer wanted to keep it, and it failed because shrinking the NTFS partition failed. The reason being that it was a fragmented NTFS volume, and it couldn't be shrunk.
That's also, sometimes I've noticed that happens. You can't shrink the NTFS partition on a dual partition system that you're trying to set up during Linux install because you have the swap file created there. And I've found that sometimes you destroy the swap file on Windows and then you can boot into the install. Once your dual boot is working and everything, then go back in and recreate your swap file and you're in good shape.
Best case for this one is you can shrink down to the last block that's allocated. And in this case, fragmented enough that there was no way to shrink the volume. Should say, one of the things I love about this is you can mount NTFS partitions in Linux. It's very cool.
That's
you can access all your... There's a new driver that should support more features of NTFS, and I think that it will support write. NTFS...
Is that right with all the caveats about it? Like, hey, this could corrupt
your
drive, or
yeah,
hey, this is unsupported?
The current
or...
one, it will support write, I believe, but you don't want to get caught using it.
Exactly.
But anyway,
well, Microsoft, we'd like some help with this. You were using what? No, I'm sorry.
I've used it a few times to save myself, and there are great Linux distributions on live CDs that include things like Undelete that will work with the NTFS driver that comes in most Linux distributions. There's a case where you can rescue Linux systems with the NTFS driver without actually having to write to the NTFS partition.
And hopefully most of the people who would be doing that kind of configuration are already technical enough to know what they're getting themselves into,
yeah.
That they're not going to be doing this for all users, saying, hey, yeah, we just mounted your NTFS partition on all your systems and we rolled it out to 20,000 SLED users or something.
Enjoy.
Enjoy.
Bon appetit.
So how to create a nice SCSI target without having to restart the daemon on SLES 10. Thought this was interesting, just that the idea of having to restart the daemon means that you have to detach all the storage that's mounted via it. And there's a way here in the TID that describes how to create a new target. And it's pretty simple. I'll leave it to the TID number, but I thought it was a good one that where we get to situations where you no longer have to restart services. Think reboot, not required. Unable to back up NSS volumes. Again, thought it was an issue just
on the
grounds.
You don't know anything about backing up NSS volumes, right, Dave?
Never been there. Never spent a couple of years working on that. Wasn't me. Never touched it. But so this comes about because a required kernel driver, SMSZ API, was not installed. Thought that was an issue worth bringing up just on the grounds that a server that's not being backed up is a server that is an open security problem.
All right.
Then we get on to the things that probably you should have known better.
Yeah, we've had a good amount of time to build up to get ourselves a few of the TIDs of the week, so let's get caught up.
NMAS 3.1 expires password when typed 3 times incorrectly.
Now, NMAS, let's make sure people know what that one is. That's Novell Modular Authentication Services.
That's correct. It's been the case for a long, long time that default installs of Novell technology that verifies passwords will expire passwords if you type them too many times wrongly. That's a security feature. So
and
that
the
you
default
can't...
policy is 3 bad logins.
Yeah.
You're locked out until you call an administrator. So if
right.
you're going with this default configuration in your organization, this is going to happen.
Yep. And it's a good thing to have enabled, but it's been a long-standing feature. It's also a feature of other operating systems authentication technology.
File under RTFM on that one.
Yep.
You know, we're picking on somebody who's a real person out there who filed this one. So if this happens to be your TID and we're making fun of you out there and you're a Novell Open Audio listener, you know, the least we can do is send you a T-shirt. All you have to do is let us know. Send to openaudio@novell.com the TID number and who you are. We'll, if it maps together with the actual TID, we'll send you a genuine, certified, valid Novell Open Audio T-shirt. Doesn't require reboot.
It would be so much better to mock a real person
exactly.
than to mock some invisible person represented by the TID.
And we promise we won't say your name on the air.
Very much.
Yeah. What's our next one?
How to convert carriage returns to line feeds and vice versa. DOS files...
Wait, what was that?
How to convert carriage returns to line feeds and vice versa. DOS end-of-line, DOS file end-of-line support. Basically, Windows handling of text files end-of-lines is different from Unix.
The travesty of Notepad. You have
yes.
to know what settings to put Notepad.
No, it's a travesty
of
even before that. Was it DIR redirected into... some file back in DOS 2 or 3. Seriously, it goes way back to there.
We want you people to use Emacs. We do not want you to use Edlin.
So Unix systems use a simple line feed, and DOS Windows system use a carriage return and line feed. It creates all sorts of problems when you transfer files. It's great compiling source code that contains carriage return line feed instead of just line feed. And ZenWorks Linux Management case of the script exceeded 30,000 characters. This is by design. It's intended so that we don't kill Tomcat. I love the analogy in my mind, killing Tomcat. But
it just sounds so anti-environmental. Yeah,
30,000 character script. That ought to be enough for any man.
after 30,000 lines, you're probably getting a little bit lengthy.
Well, we were talking earlier about pedantic. 30,000 characters, Ted. 30,000 lines of 30,000 characters, that could be really long.
Yeah.
But anyway, can't connect to remote desktop on SLED 10. This is VNC. Check the firewall. Open port 5900. Problem solved.
So somebody was just trying to get through the firewall to, like, SSH or XSFH.
VNC in this case.
Oh, VNC, but, yeah.
You know, just on a side note on that, it's always worth using tools like Nmap, Ethereal, or it's now called Wireshark, to investigate problems like that. Sniff the traffic off the wire. Use Nmap to scan the server.
Take a look at what the port number is at least, and then check out your if your gateway is letting that out.
So in this case, what would have been seen is that netstat minus L would have shown that port 5900 had a listener on it. Nmap would have shown that port 5900 was stealth, probably. Might have been closed, but it probably would have been stealth. That alone is a clue that there's a firewall involved. And Wireshark would have shown a SYN, TCP SYN, which is the initial connect packet, heading to this problem host, and nothing coming back. Mm-hmm. The SYN packet just sunk without a trace. That would have been a giveaway that there was a firewall. I do a lot of this kind of diagnosis, and it's a lot of fun. For someone like me, I guess.
It sounds like a blast. Speaking of a lot of fun,
oh, no.
before we got into the recording here, Dave was describing to us his fabulous weekend. Tell us about it, Dave.
Oh,
what did you do? Because this is like geekery spanning time.
I am a licensed ham radio operator.
That's the first part of the time in the geekery.
And I have a radio at home that is remotely controllable via serial port. So it's downstairs in my basement. And I got to thinking, you know, I wish I didn't have to go down there to use it. I wonder if I could operate it remotely from upstairs. It took me a while and a lot of software. The remote control software I have for the radio is Windows-based, but it also includes a remote serial port piece that doesn't work in Linux, but it is Windows. Installed Wine on one of my Linux boxes, loaded the remote serial port driver, and I was then able to remote control the radio. And thought, well, I've got to be able to hear it. So the next thing was to install Icecast, a streaming audio server. And now I can remotely control my ham radio from my sofa upstairs. But I can also SSH into my home network from anywhere out there in the world. And I sat in the office the other day and thought, can I do it? Called Randy into my office and set it up, and there I was, sitting in the office, remotely controlling and listening to my ham radio from the office. It's sad, I know, but that was my Sunday project.
So it's so like mid last century, and then it's so Linux at the same time. It's
But let's not forget last century was only 6 years ago.
But it doesn't sound as bad when you just say 6 years ago.
Hey, look, Marconi would have been impressed. That's good enough for me.
I bet he would. Okay, so Randy, you've been sitting here so quietly and so patiently, and I know that you've got something interesting for us. What's your tip of the week?
Well, as you know, I like to bring kind of real-world examples or applications of the technology that we have. And this week's, I brought an example of a customer who, in production, they basically clone their machines, their servers, and they have a disaster recovery site where they transfer those clones to. So if anything drastic happens in production, within moments they can have these clones up and running at their disaster recovery site. Well, the problem in this case was that at the disaster recovery site, their IP addressing scheme was different than that was in production. So they needed a way to come up with being able to bring these boxes up and not have to manually tweak every single one of them with their IP gateway. So by default, our TCP/IP stack on Linux does not support dead gateway detection, is what we would call it. And so we came up with a way to kind of make this happen, but it's not actually the TCP/IP stack that's doing it. The way to do it is just simply modifying the script, the startup script for each interface, and then there's another little script that you can pop into etc sysconfig network scripts to test for. It'll basically ping that particular interface's gateway. If it's not there, if it's not responding, then it won't bring that interface up. And so that way, when these boxes come up on the disaster recovery site, they go out, pings basically kind of a dummy sense of, hey, is this guy actually there responding? If it is, it'll bring that gateway up.
So practical scenario on that. You've got a box. I assume this is most important for server boxes.
Absolutely.
And this is then also, most server boxes are not on DHCP, so you're not going to be assigning them
exactly
out. And that's where you come up with this problem. So now you bring the server box up. One of the interfaces has this dead gateway on it. This script is actually going to identify, close down that interface. Does this cost you in penalty on services that might be using that interface?
If there were some specific services that were binding specifically to that address, sure, I could see some potential issues there.
But this would be where you have services that are using multiple interfaces, and this shuts down one of those interfaces, so you don't have the issue.
In this case, what the customer did, he had a scenario like that, but what he did is configured the services to run on both interfaces.
How do people find out more about the solution you're talking about?
There's a cool solution that was written and is out there on our website. If you search for dead-gateway detection, you'll find it, and it'll also be attached to the podcast.
We'll link to it from the show. So, great. Anything else, you guys?
Yeah. One of the places I've been for the last 4 weeks is...
That's right. You switched jobs, didn't you?
Yeah, I got a...
Your news from support, not from support anymore.
A consultancy gig.
Okay.
A 4-week consultancy gig, effectively, in Chicago at a customer. They wanted someone to come out and show them SLES 10 and to help them with a few problems they were having on a day-to-day basis. So I got out there, installed SLES 10, took about an hour on a 32-bit system, installed it again in a virtual machine. Given the virtual machine, they can pass that around and play with SLES 10 till their heart's content. Set them up an install server so that they can update it from any location without having to have the media. But the big thing was that they had a batch processing cluster, that was crashing. Individual nodes on it were crashing occasionally. The crashing itself was being deliberately caused by a driver, a cluster driver, saying that it wasn't getting a heartbeat and it was prepared to pull down the server.
And heartbeat is a critical service that actually detects whether these servers are all up, and when one of them's down,
it switches over the
services from that to another server, just so people know what heartbeat is.
Yeah, so the crash wasn't so much a crash as this cluster server saying, I'm scared that things are going to go bad, so I'm just taking this node out. But we didn't know why it was happening. We wanted to stop it happening. And I had been... Most days I have a look at Fresh Meat, freshmeat.net. That is a website associated with SourceForge, owned by the same company that sponsors SourceForge.
Tells people about new updates and new code that their projects or whatever have just recently come online.
It's a great place to go look every day and just browse the list, because that has allowed me to pick up knowledge of the existence of a whole bunch of projects that sound really cool. I have a whole list of things, bookmarks in my browser saying things to get back to that I probably never will. But the names of them stick in my mind, or the functionality sticks in my mind. If it comes up that it would be useful, I go ahead and go back to those bookmarks. Well, this was a case where I thought, we need to monitor these servers. And I remembered seeing a Fresh Meat announcement about a project called Moonin. And
that's
Moonin. M-U-N-I-N. It's a raven...
Isn't that a Disney movie?
not one I've heard of.
The male Mulan.
That's what you're talking about. So this is a Norse god's raven, Odin's raven, I believe. He had another one that I can't remember the name of. So Moonin is the project name. It's a service that polls other servers to monitor their state, stores the state in the database, and it can be HTML output can be generated from it. took me about an hour to download and build an Apache server, host it on a non-standard port so that we could keep ourselves away from anything else that was running on this server, installed the Moonin service on that host, installed the Moonin node service on all the nodes that we wanted to monitor. The service pulls those nodes every 5 minutes, stores the stuff in the database, and then generates graphs that show activity or status over a day, a week, a month, and a year.
So you get some cool trending information.
Oh, beautiful for trending, which is exactly what we needed in this case. Took me about an hour to set up the service, and then it's 10 minutes per node thereafter. In 24 hours, we'd found out that these servers at this customer needed more memory.
That was the whole thing. It was just a diagnostic that ended up being probably a relatively inexpensive way of fixing these servers up to perform again.
Certainly, the idea of being able to analyze the problem without having to be there in the middle of the night, without having to guess at possible causes and investigate them one at a time, we can monitor this whole server, all sorts of parameters about it.
Congratulations, Dave. You actually have value when you go out somewhere.
Well, you know, one of the things I'm thinking about, this ham radio thing that I mentioned and this illustrates something that I think is really important about Linux. The versatility is just immeasurable. You go out and look at Fresh Meat, you'll find all sorts of projects for things you would never consider using, and these little gems that are right for you. And Linux is the atmosphere, the landscape of Linux is just riddled with that kind of stuff.
And you guys are launching the ham radio-based News from Support show when?
Yeah, you'll get us on 3.92 megahertz.
All right. Well, guys, thanks very much for coming in, and that's pretty
Thank
much
you.
Thank
concluding
you.
News from Support. That gives us a little bit of an idea of what's going on in support, and we thank Dave and Randy, as always. And what do we got next?
We have Reverend Lovejoy.
Reverend Lovejoy. It's Robert Love.
I'm sorry. Every time I hear his name, all I can think of is Reverend Lovejoy.
And that's for those people that don't know who Reverend Lovejoy is, maybe we can link to him from the show. I don't know. But Reverend Lovejoy is, of course, the reverend on the popular American TV program, The Simpsons, which I guess is now syndicated in many countries around the world. I've seen it in Spanish in Central America.
That's actually one of my favorite is when I'm in France. I always see it in, obviously, in French because they don't do any other languages over there. And to me, it's always a riot because I speak no French at all. Yet, because of my kids, I know every single episode. So it's so cool to watch an episode when you know every word, but it's not in the language you're anticipating.
It's like Hooked on Phonics, Hooked on The Simpsons.
Exactly.
Anyway, here's Robert Love. Robert Love, welcome back to Novell Open Audio. Glad to have you here.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So we wanted to catch up with you on a lot of things. I think the last time we had you on the show was just a brief interview at Guadec with my baling wire and duct tape mobile recorder.
Literally, yeah, in Barcelona.
So it'll be very nice to have you actually with a real microphone on you. Last time we talked about a bunch of stuff like Project Utopia, Network Manager, and a lot of things like that.
Yep.
Want to catch up with you on a couple things that are going on with you because your role's changed recently. But
it has.
Also, we read on your blog, you were at Foo Camp.
I was.
Foo Camp?
What's Foo Camp? Well, it originally stood for Friends of O'Reilly. And O'Reilly, the computer book publisher and conference organizer, puts on this camp where they invite about 150 to 200, this year even more than 200, I think, individuals to their campus. And we basically camp out on their lawn in Sebastopol, which is in right outside Sonoma.
What a horrible place to have to be.
Oh, it's just disgusting. The weather's gross. The city's disgusting.
Shiny, happy people holding hands the whole thing.
It's hell. And we basically self-organize the conference. We come up with our own agenda. It's very wiki style. And basically just spend the weekend having fun and learning from each other and, as Tim says, hopefully trying to solve the world's problems.
So is there any specific goal, or is it really just whatever you guys decide the goal is?
There's no goal. And the invitee list is very odd. You know, the CEO of Amazon.com, Jeff Bezos, some of the individuals around some of the new Web 2.0 companies like Dig.com. There's some Microsoft folks, a couple guys from Novell other than myself. That's a really eclectic group.
Joe Shaw was with you there, right?
Joe Shaw was there.
Oh,
I think
Beagle
you talked
Project.
To him in Barcelona. He was there. David Riedman, the genius behind XGL, was there.
David was there.
Yep.
You hadn't told me that before.
Oh, yeah, we had a good showing. And we just get together, and it's a weird group. Joey and I did a session on implicit metadata where we sat down, and since a lot of the people with us were web entrepreneurs, we kind of got their take on implicit metadata, which is a lot different than the desktop since they have access to so much information in the aggregate.
Give us your definition on implicit metadata.
Ted, it's metadata that's not explicit.
Oh, thanks. That's much better. Cool.
Yeah, I'm there.
So some metadata is explicit. You have headers in a file. You might know that an image was taken at this location because the camera writes it, and it was taken with this camera and this shutter speed.
A web page might say in its metadata, adult, for instance.
Correct, as the pages you frequent might say.
Touche.
Your file name and date and access time. Ted's giving this look now that has to be edited out.
So exactly. This is the mic, edit that, and now I guess it'll stay in, won't it?
File name and modified date, all these things are explicit because they exist as part of the structure of the file.
And tags that we put like in FSpot on our photos or things like that, that's also explicit.
That would be explicit if the user physically adds that information. Implicit would be things we can glean from the file automatically or through some other means other than it being a physical part of the file. For example, we could always figure out perhaps that the way the user uses a file, it fits into a certain part of his or her workflow. Or we could figure out when the user has a file, we know that this file came from a certain tarball, and that tarball was sent to the user as part of a certain email, attached to an email, and that email came from a specific person. So we can build this relationship that we know, hey, this file, this image here, this belongs to Ted, and we could associate it with Ted. So when I run a search for Ted on my machine, I'll see this file. Even though the file may not have anything to do with you whatsoever, except if you walk it back up the chain, it came from you.
So it's really more in how the user interacts with the data rather than actually assigning labels to the data itself.
Very much. We determine the metadata from how the user interacts with the data.
That's freaking cool.
Ecological contexts for your data.
Yep.
So, all right. So that's cool. You were saying a little bit about getting into talking to some of these guys who are doing stuff like web stuff, Amazon, mm-hmm. whatever. And how is it different for them?
It's quite different from them because they have so much data. I mean, they generate more data in an hour than we really have on the desktop in the whole user's work cycle in a year. Just because they have so many users hitting their website so frequently, and they also have the ability to make changes to the website in response to what they measure from their users. So it might be possible that a bookseller can determine the genre of a book without actually having it explicitly tagged. So if they look at the fact that millions of people have bought this book, and if you look at all these people's overlapping interests, it's more likely than not that the book is a mystery novel or a sci-fi novel, and they could determine that and tag that to the book without the publisher actually providing the information, which is we don't have at all that ability on the desktop, and that's really neat for them.
That's just because they've got so much traffic coming through, so many ways to vector in on the information.
And they have such a large sample set of data, they can perform all sorts of statistical analysis.
I'd also imagine that because of the way that when you look at just the flow of data that they've got, because a user comes to their machine. Or it comes to their site, they do a search on a book, then you can actually watch that whole 30-minute long session that they're running on Amazon. You can see the sequence of what books they're looking at, based off what searches. There's a whole bunch of cool stuff you can analyze.
And they can mine all this data, and they do. All the web guys, they take advantage of all the data at their fingertips. It's neat opportunities.
Fascinating stuff. So that's cool. Did the session, was it pretty well received for you guys?
Yeah, I think it was. Everyone had learned a lot, and Joe and I walked away with a better understanding, at least how the web guys are solving the problem and some ideas of what we can do. But it's hard for us. So,
what's O'Reilly's interest in doing these conferences?
Well, that's a good question. Partly since they called it Friends of O'Reilly, I suppose there's some sort of they just want to get their friends together. And certainly their costs aren't large since they don't even really provide much except a place for me to put my tent.
You mean they didn't, fly you out there to have
No, they do provide, to Tim's credit, they provide excellent food and wireless, and they run the whole thing, so I'm partly kidding. But I think their biggest goal is they learn what's next. When you see who the crowd is that's out there. I mean, 4 years ago, the Google founders were there. Stephen Levy, the Newsweek editor and the guy who wrote Hackers, which is a book that I read when I was getting started, he was there this year and last year. So the crowd's just so so interesting that, you know, I think O'Reilly, and they say this, they learn what's next, and they get some new ideas from us.
Cool. Well, all right, so your role's changing.
Yep.
And I talked to Nat Friedman about this at Linux World, and you told me, I think, somewhere around that same time that you'd be out this way.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about it. What are you doing? What's the new thing?
I've moved from engineering in the Linux desktop team to the role of chief architect of our Linux desktop. In this capacity, I am in charge of our longer-term technical direction and our overall system architecture.
You're still going to code?
I hope so. That's part of the description.
Yeah, so it would seem like you would have to, because, I mean, you've been pretty interactive in the community for quite a while, and you've also been one of the people who's helped to do some of the liaison building between SUSE, Zimian, Novell,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of stuff. So it would seem like part of your strength is that you've been known as a guy who develops some code and works on interesting projects.
I don't think that will change.
Okay, that's good.
Yep.
So desktop architect, what do you think it is going to entail?
Well, I'm going to try to follow up SLED 10 with something even better. One of the roles I see myself
playing... No pressure,
playing,
dude.
Yeah. I was hoping that SLED 11 would just have to be somewhat as good, but we're setting the sights even higher.
Start paying David Reifman big bucks right now. I mean, just start, you know, personally, you to him.
Make it possible. Where I see a big role is we have so many components on the desktop. And it's useful to have someone who has their fingers a little bit in everything, can understand the interrelationships and coordinate between the teams and make sure that our overarching and overall global architecture is correct. So that's largely where in SLED 11 I see myself playing.
But you don't have, like, even at this point, probably between you, Guy Lenardi, and other people who are going to be instrumental in deciding what's going to be there. You guys probably don't even have – you just got SLED 10 out the door.
Right.
So you're probably not right now even narrowing down on the features because you're facing Service Pack 1, those kind of things at the moment.
We're starting to work on it.
But can we put in our wish list right now to you?
Sure, hit me.
All right. So you worked on Network Manager, and one of the things that was so cool about that is the idea of being able to detect the network being online or offline and have things – be able to instrument off of that. So Evolution goes offline the moment mm-hmm. it sees the network disconnect. Game does the same thing.
Yep.
They come back online when they're done. This is getting pretty close to presence.
Correct.
And that seems like one of the things that we could really use to jump Linux desktop ahead is
yep.
some intelligence about where people are, when they're online, and also if we can even go beyond that into some of the identity management areas, it would be really nice to have the Aaron can show Ted when he's online or not, but not you because he doesn't like you.
Right, so I've heard. And he doesn't.
Yeah. Actually, one of the things right off of what you're talking about, one of the things that I want is when I leave the office here, I mean, it is fantastic that when it sees a network connection, my game authenticates, my Evolution email authenticates and everything. But when I go home, I don't necessarily want game to pop on specifically to the GroupWise instant messaging service on the back end. I don't mind my private account, but I want to manually flip that thing on.
Yeah. Support for profiles or locations, some people might call them, is something we're looking at for SLED 11.
So there is some of this is already on
your definitely.
Mind.
And going back to your original point about presence, we looked at that for SLED 10, and there is some basic presence functionality actually in place. But I think it'll get much bigger attention in SLED 11, and we could do some really neat things.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, good luck in this role and everything. That sounds pretty cool.
Thank you.
I guess that means that you're living pretty much full-time on SLED 10.
Well, I have been. I've developed it and have been running it full-time. Although lately, I'm actually running our OpenSUSE builds on my main laptop.
Like the stuff that's leading up toward 10.2's release?
Yep.
Probably this winter.
Right out of the community.
Wow. All right. Why is that? Why would you be using that rather than your product, quote unquote?
Well, they both pull from the same code base. And so it's not a huge step forward. But one, I want to live in the community. I want to use the same code that our users can use. Two is I'm already starting to think what's next. And 10.2 is the next step towards SLED 11.
What are we at right now on that, Aaron? It's like beta... Or not even beta. It's like alpha 3.
Yeah, we're
right?
not even on a
it's,
on a beta
it's early.
Yet.
The
other thing is he's not really our target audience for SLED.
Absolutely.
I mean, SLED is much more geared towards our typical basic office worker rather than somebody who's going to be developing code or, you know, popping out to a terminal.
Yep.
Are you having to do a lot of when you're working on not SLED but on SUSE Linux or OpenSUSE 10.2's early phases here, are you finding that it's rough? Are you finding that it's stability, I guess, is the biggest thing, because I expect interfaces to possibly not work as well in alpha code particularly. But are you finding that the platform itself has issues?
It's certainly not as polished or as stable as SLED 10, which is, you know, quite an enterprise-class product. But surprisingly, I am not seeing a lot of issues. I update daily. I'm really on the bleeding edge, and it largely works perfect.
Great. You did a bunch of work, of course, when you were on Network Manager. Mm-hmm. You did a lot of work to get SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop and even SUSE Linux 10.1, now OpenSUSE. Mm-hmm. You did a lot of work to get that thing working well in that. But that was, when you say you develop in community, that particular project, that wasn't originally a Novell project. Can you give us a little of the background of where that started and what your role is to it now?
Sure. The project actually started external to Novell. It was a GNOME project started by an individual at Red Hat. And we were working on, slightly before that, a system called NetApplet, unrelated to Network Manager. And we decided to transition to Network Manager. And at first, it was not a Novell project. And I kind of came in late to the game. And today, I'm the co-maintainer in Novell, along with Red Hat are kind of the two main contributors. So we've largely engaged the community, and with the work of the community, done a lot of made a lot of great progress.
Okay, so Robert, you said just a minute ago that you actually run 10.2. I run SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop as my main desktop.
Great.
If I go and I grab one of the alpha builds of 10.2, am I going to see some of the cool things? Like, I love Slab, the new GNOME main menu.
Me too, yep.
Is that in 10.2?
It is. 10.2 is just really a continuation of the same code base. At Novell, we roll all of the Linux all of the Linux products from the same code base. All of the architectures build from the same code base, and it's just a rolling release. So 10.2 is just a newer, more exciting, although less stable version of SLED 10.
Right, not,
so
you not will, tested you'll as
have,
heavily.
You'll have the slab and everything else.
How about easy to install and configure desktop effects or XGL? Because I tried that on my own, and it was just a pain until I used SLED.
I think right now the code's about the same as SLED 10.
Okay, so it kind of automatically goes out, grabs the driver,
yep.
And it's just point and click for me, which I like a lot better than hacking files.
And then, well, I guess that leads also to the question, though. So we didn't have the slab inside of, or this new GNOME main menu. We didn't have it in 10.1. Mm-hmm. Presumption on that, was it just not done yet?
Nope, correct. It was developed pretty late in the SLED 10 cycle, and it made its first debut in SLED 10. But it is in the 10.2 alphas, and it will be in 10.2 final.
All right.
Yep.
Robert, thanks very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Appreciate catching up with you, and that's pretty much a wrap.
Great. My pleasure.
But that about does it for Reverend Lovejoy. Let's wrap up the show here. So that's pretty much it for Novell Open Audio this week. Remember, go online, hit the survey that we're putting online. And remember also that Novell Open Audio is brought to you by Novell Users International in conjunction with Novell Incorporated. You can go and rate any show, including this one, online after you listen to it by just going to novell.com/openaudio and check out any episode there to rate it. We love to get the ratings from people, and we especially love to get the per-episode comments because it does give us a lot of feedback. But if you want to give us more direct feedback, you can always send us email to openaudio@novell.com. That's a wrap for this episode. We'll see you next time.